You're listening to Death of the Reader. Flex and Herds here for your Murder Mystery World Tour, and we are here in our final, all-spoilers-encompassing week discussing The Mystery Writer by Solari Gentil, friend of the show.
Yeah.
Herds, you know I am a Solari Gentil apologist through and through.
I know.
And I'd like to apologize.
That's why I was so excited to, like, get into this book. I'm so excited to hear your unfiltered opinions about this wild madhouse ending.
Oh yeah.
That is worthy horror movie flick. Like, what is happening?
This book exceeded all my expectations. To recap you on what's happened since we last left off, Mary Cowell, the journalist.
She was killed.
She was killed.
That happened in the last section. Catch up. But yes, we're investigating her murder.
And then we start investigating her murder. It seems that the forums, the shield, are starting to be cleft in twain as Wayward Son begins to posit a bit more reality into that place. And we then slowly start to pick apart, you know, Theo's innocence in the case. The police are more and more onto her, even though it seems to us that she has absolutely no chance of being the killer.
Yeah, well, what they pose is that for whatever reason, Theo seems to be the connected tissue between all of the cases. So if you smell a certain something wherever you go, maybe check your shoe, Theo is the shoe. Unfortunately, in this case, your shoe has been replaced with a shoe that you didn't know existed.
Oh, yeah.
By Veronica Cole, who is Satan incarnate.
Yeah, I mean, because basically what happens is in chapter 28, Theo gets into a car,
yeah,
and then she's just gone.
She disappears. She just leaves.
She's not there anymore. Yeah.
Well, to be fair, let's hold on. There's context here. Before she leaves, there is a catalyst occurrence. Last week, you were like, how are you going to get Theo to take the devil's deal? And the answer is, we shoot somebody. We shoot Gus by the police. In his own office, apparently, mm-hmm. And Jackie is there because she's our love interest for him now, apparently.
And
we lock Mac up in a prison because he might have done something wrong at some point.
He's in there for months. We have a time skip.
Yeah, we have multiple time skips. It's very strange. And Theo is taken away forever.
Because I think what is most disorienting about this time skip, and I wanna call someone out here, okay?
Is it me? It's not me, is it?
No, I wanna call out ABC Radio National's Bookshelf.
Oh no. What have you done? Are you starting a war?
I had to listen to those episodes, and they spoke about this book as though the middle third didn't exist.
You mean the best part of the book?
The best part of the book didn't exist.
Oh no.
And it was just so interesting because I felt like they had this discussion of how Gus and Mac come in and basically are the authority figures that get to decide what Theo is doing when it's supposedly a story about a woman kind of breaking out of her family's control and making it on her own. When to me, like, that's the point, right?
Maybe. I'm going to be honest. I haven't listened to these episodes, but I have some similar thoughts about the breeding couples that we get at the end of this book. That's what they are. I may have to talk with the bookshelf. We've ended up in a bit of a sticky wicket here, haven't we? Because I also have a rant that we end up with a couple that Gus pre-approves for Theo, and then we end up with these nice, neat little couples at the end.
But yeah, yes, I'm not saying
continue
that
the rest
wrong.
Of your I'm, thought, please.
I'm not saying
save
that
yourself.
Wrong. But I'm saying here that their reaction shows to me that pieces of the puzzle weren't fitting together.
I agree.
There's like three thirds of this book that are each doing something so different that it is difficult to comprehend.
Okay.
Right? The fact that I am thinking about the shield as this overarching narrative device when arguably it isn't there for more than half of the book by chapter count.
It's there to push Caleb into doing something stupid and moving them from one house to the next.
Yeah. Once Caleb's done something stupid, it's kind of pointless. After Caleb goes in and he's like, actually, Theo might not be guilty. It doesn't do anything for the rest of the narrative. They literally just show up and say, the afterlife was published. There is a message. And that's it. That's all the shield does for the last third
Can
of the
I
book.
Can I tell you what I think that the sort of miscommunication is? Aside from the gender stuff going on there. I think that there is a miscommunication here with the sort of overarching, like what we're told that the message is around the way that the publisher in this case, because it's Daedalus, they're the bad guys, whatever. They like control people through narratives, and that is present through S.H.I.E.L.D., right? But when we actually come down to the climax of the novel, it's about a bunch of dudes with guns.
Yes.
I feel like getting Theo to commit to working with Daedalus through the narrative that they're building around her, that she can't possibly escape, is a good device, but it doesn't quite hit where it hurts when she actually like makes the commitment. I feel like that may have been a better place to reveal what was going on in the novel. And regardless of that decision, any in a standoff with guns on a rooftop with a sniper, I don't think that it aligns with the thesis around like the way that we're controlled by narratives.
Theo effectively in the closing sequences of the book has left enough messages
in bottles
that Mac and Gus had access to in her published book under this pseudonym that Daedalus has given her, that they are able to intercept her while she is on holiday in the United States on a research trip to break her out effectively. And it is this like helicopter landing, gun-toting showdown where all of these characters from earlier in the book turn out to be assassins hired by the publisher.
It's so strange because we have characters from earlier in the book who turn out to be assassin riders, which is fun. I like that idea. There's also a cop siege that goes wrong because someone pretends to be, it's Veronica, pretends to be Theo on the phone saying, "I've got a bomb in the building, so don't come in here or I'll blow myself up." And then there's the sniper, and there's Gus and Mac trying to get in. And then there's Patsy McKenney, who is an entirely new character who just showed up out of nowhere. She's got the helicopter. Well, not out of nowhere. She's a redneck with a helicopter. And I half expected her to start firing missiles at the building. That's what I was expecting.
Oh, yeah.
Like, there's a lot of stuff going on.
But the other thing that's most confusing is as we get into this big action sequence, as you have been foreshadowing the entire run of episodes we've done, Herds, there is a gun-toting showdown at the Ponderosa, the Etheridge family compound, off screen!
Yes. Well, we see two cars slam into another car and we hear them go, "Yeah, my brothers have been trained to defend this compound." And I go, "Awesome, let's defend the compound." But then, yeah, we cut away from it. I do want to say while we're here in the story section, we're enjoying very much.
It's true. There's going to be a big mystery discussion at the
end
of this
one. I know, it's going to be great. I wanted to say that I enjoy the through line of the publishing company controlling people in the same way that the families are controlling their children.
Yes, yes.
And I think that the way that Solari says, you know, maybe this Daedalus association is not too different from these isolated communities that sort of branch off from Americana or from, you know, society, right? I really enjoy the way that those ideas are working in harmony there.
Yeah, I think the interesting thing about Mac and Gus in this story is that they are sort of a bit of a participation by irony device in the plot.
Sure. Yeah, yeah.
Where so much of this story, as you say, is about escaping those controlling chains, be it from your publishers, be it from your family. And Gus and Mac are kind of presented as these like safe guideposts, right? Where they have their skills, Theo has her skills, and they all play into them. And them playing into their respective skills is like how we get the good ending you were saying was so important to the end of this book. But because the male figure's skills are knowing what to do in tough situations, and this book is filled with tough situations, it has this really weird subtext that comes out of that.
There are a couple of constructions that are just part of the plot that we're going to have to talk to Solari about this, but like the fact that Theo becomes a damsel in distress, I know that she uses the impromptu flamethrower to get the fire escape going, but then that doesn't really go anywhere. She just gets cornered anyway. And the other one, of course, just to like lay it out there, is that the only reason that that she meets Mac is because Gus sends Mac over to protect his little sister. So even though it is not explicitly Gus saying, hey, you should date Mac instead of all those older men that I've told you to stay away from, it is implicit that because of Gus's approval of Mac, that's how they end up together in the first place. I want to be clear. I want to take this positively. I still have thoroughly enjoyed reading this book, and I'm excited to get to the mystery section. I don't know how we're going to deal with that, but...
Like, at the very least, I can confidently say, before we move to the mystery section, this is the best thriller novel that Solari has ever written.
Are you trying to say this is the only thriller novel she's ever written?
I said nothing of the sort.
I haven't read enough of her books to... I don't know. What genre are those, like, what are the hero books? What are those? Anyway, shall we move on?
Yes, you're listening to Death of the Reader, your murder mystery world tour. We are discussing Solari Gentil's The Mystery Writer all the way to the end. Full spoilers in the house here on 2SER 107.3. Stick around.
You're listening to Death of the Reader. This is Flex and Herds in the studio with Solari Gentil to discuss full spoiler questions for The Mystery Writer. And it's lovely to have you back in here for a second round. But Solari, you're writing this story. It's all about these complicated big ideas, conspiracies, interwoven sort of political problems. But the story ends in an explosion of action and high-stakes gunplay. It feels... to me, tonally very different from the conclusions of your two previous standalone works. Can you tell me a bit about why you've experimented here with an action movie ending that the readers may not be expecting?
I think it naturally followed the subject matter. So what I was trying to do was have the story that Theo was living and Dan and Gus were living reflect the conspiracy theory. So what you have is, in the beginning, it starts with something small, little observations. Then all of a sudden, everything else seems to be related to it, and everything else twists to become related to it. And it always, the thing about conspiracy theories is they always seem to build up to this big climatic ending. And it seemed to be a natural way that it headed. And because, you know, I was writing it from Theo's point of view and from Gus's point of view, it seemed that even if there was a calmer way of interpreting those events, they would have been interpreted by those characters with that heightened insanity.
We often talk on the show about transitioning from book one to book two of a story where, like, once you've realized what all of the twists and turns are going to be, it's not that the book is ruined for you, it's that you're now reading a different book. And I love that Daedalus is such a mechanized way to experience that in The Mystery Writer. It was actually so much fun.
Yeah, look, and I... Look, I have no excuse. I will say that my agent did say, "Are you sure you want to do this?" But to me, the personal enjoyment I got by doing it outweighed any literary considerations that might have persuaded me otherwise.
I mean, I think that's very poignant. Like, as you say, this novel you've written, you clearly had fun writing it, and all these decisions where I'm thinking, this wouldn't fly in a real world setting, that because it's fun and it's tropey and like the helicopter flying. And, you know, when we were discussing on the show, I compared it to a horror B movie where there just happens to be a paramilitary organization nearby that can fix all our problems. I do enjoy that for the Doomsday Prepper family, like all of the actions, and don't take this as a stance on gun violence definitively, I enjoy that all of the times when we see the family use their guns or use excessive force, they're having fun with it, but it's also in the name of like looking after their family. Like even the first time we see, I forget the brother's name. It's the brother that's not Caleb or Zeke.
Oh yeah. No,
it's not Caleb, Zeke or Mac. It's the other brother that I've Troy maybe. Anyway, he's got a gun to Theo's head and he's doing this because he thinks she's invaded their family home. And then when they use the tanks later on, it's because Max asked them to, and da 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 da. All the times when we see them use excessive violence, it's done for these sort of empathetic reasons. They're trying to protect their family or help them out, which I do really appreciate, actually. I think that's like a fun way to approach these supposed rednecks, right?
And it's very American, isn't it? It's sort of apple pie and mom and
mom's great.
You know, grab your rifle and let's go out with the family.
and that's
fine. It's a cultural difference. And one of the things that I think it's important to do, particularly if you're a writer writing in another country, is to try and not do it in a way that's judgmental.
I was curious. You end the novel in a way that I feel is very safe. Our two couples get together, the evil Daedalus is defeated, and there's this classic note of, you know, when will the bad guy come back? Which might happen, but there's nothing kind of concrete. I felt like the ending to this novel is less ominous than your previous books, which end in violence or imprisonment. Why did you decide to end this novel on such a safe note this time around?
I didn't think it was safe.
You don't think it was safe?
No, Veronica's still out there. The whole system and the whole society that built Daedalus, that built that whole notion or that ability to manipulate, that's still out there. They haven't solved any of that.
That's true.
They've added a few writers.
I felt like our main characters, our four couple, our couple gang, Scooby-Doo gang, have the tools to combat that threat. Whereas in the previous novels, I think that they were all facing imminent destruction. Like, I don't think there was any way out of the conclusions to the other.
Oh, people. Okay.
Maybe that's a better way of phrasing it.
Maybe, okay. There may be a number of reasons. One is that a lot of people hated the endings to the last two books.
Oh, okay.
They were really upset about them. That usually doesn't influence me, but I was aware of how much people hated those endings. Perhaps I was afraid of becoming Stephen King. But I think I didn't actually see it that way. I actually thought that the threat is still there. And part of the threat as it exists in the mystery writer is this feeling of safeness, this feeling that everything's normal. And that's where things like Daedalus and conspiracy theories, that's where they flourish. You know, when things are normal and quiet and people aren't, you know, people don't come up with conspiracy theories when the world is at war.
I mean,
because they've got other things to do.
This is arguably true, except that is the pandemic, when we saw this huge surge in conspiracy theories, a time of safety.
Yeah, but we were sitting around, people who are making up these conspiracy theories
nothing
were sitting
do.
Around in the safety of their lounges with nothing to do. They weren't off, you know, on the front, you know, or in the trenches trying to wage war, or they weren't, you know, in ambulances and so on. My guess is that doctors and nurses and the kind of people who are really flat strapped during the pandemic weren't making up conspiracy theories.
But it is also that separation between like physical safety and emotional safety, I think is the thing that's getting me there.
That'll about do us for the spoiler chat. Thank you very much for joining us again this week for the mystery writer, Solari. And now let's get into the final section for this book. You're, of course, listening to Death of the Reader on 2SCR 107.3. Stay tuned.
You're listening to Death of the Reader. Flex and Herds here for your Murder Mystery World Tour. We are here in our final week, all spoilers, discussing Solari Gentil's The Mystery Writer. And it's time to talk about the mystery in The Mystery Writer, Herds.
What's the mystery?
What is the mystery here?
You're asking me? Oh, no, wait. You're the Solari Gentil apologist.
Because I'm clever like that.
Yeah. Turning the chessboard around. I see how it is. The mystery is... Who is Veronica? No, that's not the mystery. The mystery is how many people can a mega corporation kill before people start to figure out that they're killing people? Because apparently it's a lot. I don't know. I think that it still is the most bizarre part of the mystery to me. There are conspiracies that exist in real life, but this sort of conspiracy, I feel like, would not last 2 months. I feel like be exposed, especially with all the wordplay and the fact that they don't actually have that tight of control over their writers. Like, they just let Dan Murdoch live in a town and talk to people. Are you kidding me?
Well, it seems like Dan was sort of allowed under supervision because, you know, there are other people in the bar, for example, who are also from the conspiracy. But I think the interesting thing about it is that the characterization of the conspiracy is still kind of really interestingly detailed in the bits of the mystery that are mysterious, right? Like, why didn't Daedalus just kill Theo as soon as she had found just about anything out?
You mean like when Dan Murdoch was going to send her the manuscripts? You mean, is that what you mean by found anything out? Or do you mean like, yeah?
Yeah. When she like sent her manuscript in and when she was starting to talk with them about it, why was it not just easier to kill her?
Well, I believe in that moment it was because they were looking at, oh God, I'm having Dune flashbacks. They thought that they'd found her Gomjabar, whereas they had lost Dan Murdoch's, which I know is a reference that's lost on you if you haven't read or watched Dune. But anyway,
the concept of a weakness is not something exclusive to Dune, Ben.
Yeah, but you don't get to say Gomjabar, put your hand in the box. Volatrides, Dan Murdoch, put your hand in the box. And he'd be like, I won't do it. And then they'd stab him because that's what happened. Anyway, look, here's the thing. I think that they realized in the fiction that they could no longer control Dan Murdoch because now he was possessed with a desire to reveal the truth. Whereas Theo is a young, stupid college dropout who has no prospects and an emotional brother that they can use to control her, right? They've got this whole story planned out for her. But Dan Murdoch, he controls the story, so they just have to stab him.
There's all these ideas of, like, the amount of control that they have over her, and also this idea that perhaps they're kind of greedy because they go to all of this effort to create this situation when they could pick another writer that wasn't as difficult to corner as Theo was. Or maybe the idea that all of these situations are as complicated and that Dan Murdoch's whole, you know, cancelling in the past was actually created by Daedalus. There's so many interesting questions that we're left with that aren't answered, and I feel like it's compellingly so.
Solari, in the conversation with the author at the back of the book, she talks about how the three standalone novels, they're no longer necessarily the three meta-narrative novels, but the three standalone novels are about different relationships, right? So After She Wrote Him was about the writer's relationship with her characters, and there's one character in particular. The Woman in the Library is about the relationship between the writer and the reader, which is, again, one character to another character. And The Mystery Writer is about, quote, the writer's place in society and the power of story to influence behavior. I could probably, like, lowball that and say it's about the publisher's relationship with the writer. Like, that seems to be kind of the focal point if we're going to pick a character. But the way that this novel is written, it's not about a one-on-one relationship. It's about, like, a corporation's relationship with many writers at once.
I think that's one way you could read it. I think the other thing that's sort of interesting about it is that Theo is the entire book along portrayed as the culprit for all of these crimes that are going on.
Sure.
Because of a lack of evidence otherwise.
That's true. That's true. There's no basis to suspect anyone.
And I think that you could also look at this as, like, the writer's perspective on how it feels to be, like, accused for all of these things that happen in your book that aren't necessarily your machination.
Sure, sure.
The story that you mean to tell and the story that other people read in that Here It Comes kind of death of the author way.
Uh-oh. It's actually just to the reader. I don't know if you know what show you're on, Flex, but there's no,
you're right.
There's no authors here. Right. We're not authors.
There are no authors here.
There are no authors, full stop.
But it very much could be read as that Theo is about the author's experience in this world that is seeing you entirely in third person that you have no control over. Right.
Sure. I'm totally happy to go down the rabbit hole of control debate because it's a big philosophical thing. And that's what, I mean, we talked about this in the last chat, but that's what these, like, the commune and the Ponderosa, the message boards are all about, right? Like, people feel like they have no control and they'll do some really wacky things to try and regain it. They'll disconnect themselves from technology or go online and find like-minded people to obsess over minute details or build a giant castle in the woods. These are all rational things that people do. So I will agree with you. I'll go down this road that, yeah, there is the like, Theo is losing control of her life. And Daedalus comes along and says, we will give you control back. And by give you control back, we mean we will take control of it.
Yes.
We will fix everything. We will take the strands of your life, the book that you can't quite put together that you'd like to, you know, bring to the world with mass market appeal. And we just want to, you know, control, you know, little things here and there. But all those little things here and there, in the same way that, like, the little nudges that they put on the events of this novel, they completely ruin her life. But those little nudges in terms of the publisher relationship as well can completely change the book that you're trying to write, or the story that you want to tell, or the way that the public perceives you as well.
Yeah, right. Because the whole setup at the start of the book is that Theo has escaped, quote unquote, from this world of control and particularly of this world of law to go into the escape that is writing, only to find that it is another form of control, as you're saying there. And I think that that is very much the same style of experience that I think Solari was commenting on when she was looking at how it felt to be perceived in contrast to the literary world in Crossing the Lines, or after she wrote him, where that book was very much, you know, early in her career, Solari has mentioned she'd go to literary events and be presented awards, and she was like the outcast at those events, in the same way that the characters in Crossing the Lines are sort of from two completely separate worlds while they're doing the same thing. And if you take Solari's background in the law, she's gone over to writing and she's found that it's like a different problem of the same kind. I think that the types of metafiction that Solari writes are intentionally or not autobiographical. And I think that reading into how that personal journey from the author's perspective, as she says in that bit you were quoting her, is like the most interesting lens into the book as a whole. I think it's the thing that ties the three disparate thirds together.
That's a look. That was an excellent little bit of talking you did there. I enjoyed that. You clearly thought a lot about that before you spoke, which I appreciate. I wish I could think that much. No, I mean, look, I agree. Control is definitely like the central piece of the novel there. And look, I clearly need to read more of Solari Gendel's biography, just generally. Anyway, I think that probably does us for now.
Yeah, we're being waved out of the studio by our editorial team. They've said enough, Solari, enough.
Well, my editorial team is giving me a page right now. They're interested in coming on the show.
Oh, there you go.
But I don't know if there's enough room for the three of us, and by that I mean I'm kicking you out.
Oh, what?
I'm kicking you out for next week.
Just next week or for the next book?
Of the next book.
Oh,
at least
gosh.
The next book, if not more.
I'm being replaced.
So we're actually going to be doing something super wacky. Flex is going off to another entire universe for the next book. And I'm going to be covering, with the help of the editor-in-chief, Cameron Furlong, we're going to be covering It Takes a Town, subtitled To Solve a Murder by Effie Clifford. We're going to be reading up until chapter 11. And that's a book about a child star. She's like a singer who gets murdered, and she's the hot stuff for this small town. And who could possibly have reason to kill her? It's gonna be great.
I like
it's gonna
the be sound great time. That. That's very exciting.
Look forward to it. Oh, and Cam's solving, so I get to torment him, which is gonna be really fun.
You're just taking as many breaks as you can this year, Herds.
Let's go. Look, I'll have to make up for it because I'm running behind on points.
That's true.
To catch up.
I mean, listen, you're in charge here. You can invent some scheme to take Cam's points.
It's true. Hold on. Let me go to my scheming room and I'll figure up a scheme.
This is Death of the Reader. Flex and Herds here for your Murder Mystery World Tour. I will see you in a book's time, but Herds will be back next week with Cam Furlong for some Aoife Clifford. one of our previous honorable mention winners on review season here on the show. Super excited for that. Catch you around. This is your Murder Mystery World Tour here on 2SER 107.3. We're out of here.
He's out of here. I'm in control now. Let's go. 3 more weeks. 3 more weeks.